where's the house now? What's the matter?
My feet are killing me. Why didn't you tell me we needed oil before I went back for the gas, Sam?
Because I gave you a $50 bill and the gas was only $5. Maybe you come back, maybe you wouldn't. I couldn't take that chance, Angel.
Don't you trust me, Sam?
Trust you? The last time that I trusted a dame was in Paris in 1940. She said she was going out to get a bottle of wine. 2 hours later, the Germans marched into France.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sam.
Sorry, nothing. Give me my change.
Welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sean McGee, who we're going to ask right up top, what kind of man are you?
I'm the kind of man whose monologues you can interrupt and like a fucking ADD squirrel.
Oh, guilty as charged. This is a show where Sean and I force off trading one another our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening, Rappy. Jesus Christ, let me take that hole from the after the guilty as charged. This is a show where Sean and I force off trading one another. Force off trading. To watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you have to be listening from. You can be doing anything else with your time. We're happy you're here with us. You can follow our socials in the show notes while scrolling down there. Please rate, review, give our podcast some stars, some likes, some comments, some interaction, some anything. We want to press upon, I think we want to maybe take some time now, press upon everybody the Uncle Ann's secret stash, private stash, still working that all out. But she has a really exciting raffle going on. We should have made more of a bigger deal of this in contact. Definitely going to make a big deal of it in this episode and for damn sure in 9 to 5. But any interaction gets you a entry into our raffle this month. And the creme de la creme, the prize of this raffle, is this awesome Nick Cage. What is it? Bespeckled? Is that the right term for it? I'm not really sure.
Oh, God. Oh, I'm too stoned to remember what the word is.
She's got a cool Nick Cage jacket, and it's hilarious. I don't know. We got to find a way to start posting that in.
All I can think of is the joke where I was going to say bedazzled.
Bedazzled, that's the fucking word.
Bedazzled, thank you. I can only remember the bedazzled version of the word, and I was dying there. Ugh.
I never bedazzled anything in my life, so I'm excited to at least give it away as a prize. I mean, it's really awesome, heart-shaped Nick Cage, really funny face, along with a couple DVDs and some comics that we've been talking about over the course of the podcast. So a lot of fun stuff, cool raffle. We're looking for, do we decide? Does it matter? The first maybe 5 people that interact at all, comments on the Patreon, a like, a subscribe. Something gets you an entry into the raffle at later point. We'll go.
We'll say like any interaction basically is an entry in the raffle, and then we have an end date, and then we randomly generate.
For sure, yeah. Raffles, they're.
I'll do some nerd shit.
And we also want you to join us on Patreon for exclusive shows. We got some entertaining exclusives over there. McGee, I'm going to toss it to you for what people could be pairing with the man who wasn't there this month.
See, we could do some noir stuff that we've covered in the past, but instead, I think, as you'll hear from my take on the movie later, I think the more apt comparison is something like, what's the Scorsese pool movie? Color of Money. I think Color of Money is the comparison that I'm going to make. And I'll explain myself later what I mean. But it's just a good episode. And Paul Newman's hot.
That's really interesting. Because there is a sense of disillusionment that I want to kind of comment on. And I think you maybe have narrowed in something in our catalog I hadn't thought about. So on today's episode, we have a pick. My pick for this week. It's in 2001's The Man Who Wasn't There. We're going to dive into this film with our world-famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes stories. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 01's The Man Who Wasn't There.
Sooner or later, everyone needs a haircut. For the kids, there's the Butch or the Heine, the Flat Top, the Ivy, the Junior Contour, and occasionally the Executive Contour. Me, I don't talk much. I just cut the hair.
You say he was being blackmailed. By who? You don't know. For having an affair. With who? You don't know. Did anyone else know about it? Probably not. You don't know. You want to test something, you know, scientifically. How the planets go around the sun, why the water comes out of the tap. You got to look at it. But sometimes you look at it, your looking changes it.
Life has dealt me some bum cards, or maybe I just haven't played them right. I don't know.
Life is just so damn wonderful, you almost won't believe it.
They put their pants on one leg at a time, just like you and me.
You keep your mouth shut. I'm an attorney. You're a barber. You don't know anything.
I'm not proud of what I did, but you, what kind of man are you?
All right, that was from the trailer of The Man Who Wasn't There. This is, or I guess if I'm doing a Billy Bob, I gotta like lower my voice artificially and fry it out while I'm doing this.
I'm sick of that was your, from the... in between your forefinger and ring.
Here we go. That was from the trailer from The Man Who Wasn't There, written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, shot by Roger Deakins, the living legend. Starring Billy Bob Thornton as Ed Crane, Frances McDormand as Doris Crane, Michael Badalucco as Frank, James Gandolfini as Big Dave Brewster, and John Polito as Tolliver, and of course, Tony Shalhoub as Freddy Riedenschneider.
I'm going to take these credits and go outside and mix them with common house dirt.
All right. So as always, I can't do that voice the whole episode. It will absolutely murder me. But that's this. I think that this is more the register that Billy Bob's voice should be in, but he's making himself sound way cooler.
As only Bob, Billy Bob can.
But anyway, starting, as always, with the titular question, Eric, why'd you make us watch this?
Yeah, I think this is, for obvious reasons, this is an overlooked Coen Brothers film. You know, we're in the, 01 was a exciting year. You know what? No, we're going to cut that. 01 was a telling year or a...
Momentous. Let's go with momentous.
There we go.
Fucking hell.
And I think the nature of the film and some of the, what we'll get into thematically about this disillusionment and almost like this midlife crisis, this like interior explosion that's happening where it's very quiet, but it's all encompassing and it like destroys lives. And it's so interesting in the way that it plays out in this film where so many people are damaged by these fronts that they put up and these facades that they put up or what their expectations were versus where they are in their lives. I think I'm sharing a little bit of that as, you know, as an older millennial where it feels like just every fucking thing that was taught or told or who you kind of looked up to, who you're, whatever it was, it all kind of feels like that was a big fat, you know, just a fucking lie or really thin or sort of a story. And I think you buy into that. Some people reach that revelation, I think, a little earlier than others. I'm assuming my co-host, that's something he was maybe, I mean, he was born in a gulag, so he probably understood that lesson way earlier than... that I did, but it's weird, and I think when you enter in this midlife crisis moment that we see Ed Crane here having, where you know he has this profession that he's, you know, I don't know, he's gifted is not the right word, he's proficient at, but there's no joy in the process at all, and there's no he's in a joyless marriage, he's in a sexless marriage, he's in a joyless marriage, he's in a joyless profession. He's like, and so every little thing, it feels like that. It, one of the funny things I love is him walking out to his house with these, like, I got a garbage disposal and a gas reef, so I guess you can see I have it made or whatever. Like, these little things you were sold on the American Dream are like, if you just do this, X, Y, and Z, you know, this is the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in that kind of period, so it's so interesting. I watched this film back in college. I've maybe seen it two times before that, but then we have the January Criterion release, and I'm sitting with the commentary and just visiting the film, because there are other aspects about this film I think that may be not challenging, but a little out of place if you're not paying attention to it close enough. Some of the UFO 40s panic, the technological panic of that time,
yeah,
is spruced in here in a way that could be a bit off-putting if you're not seeing how it's all beautifully woven in. But I really enjoy this interior panic that Ed is going through throughout the film. And I think the Coens can sort of sell a barber whose dream is to be a dry clean, a half owner of a dry cleaning business. And then that dream's deferred. And he's like, well, then maybe I can pivot and be like a concert hall pianist agent. So like we'll try to work this dream. And it is like a man trying to find himself in the later stage of his life in the most haphazard way possible. Another large aspect of putting this on is Deakins shot the fucking shit out of this movie. This is
fucking
gorgeous
shit.
Like,
man, every shot is so perfect. Deakins shot the fuck out of this movie.
Yeah.
God damn. That's, he is just like, time and again, just like
let
one
me go
of
to you
the...
for your reaction. I'm curious. That's about where I am with it. I love Ed's journey in this. I think we're going to find some really funny, fun things to talk about this. But Deakins shooting this is incredible. And Tony Shalhoub, we're going to get into later on the episode.
Oh,
John
my God.
Polito,
yeah.
Too. I mean, the whole side of it. We're going to talk about Catherine Berowitz and Polito and fucking Richard Jenkins as like the drunk dude. Incredible.
Yeah.
A lot of fun things to break down in this film. Where are you at with it, McGee?
I mean, this is a bunch of masters at work, but not quite a masterpiece.
Interesting.
Was what I wrote in my notes. Where, like you said, it's a lesser Coen brothers, which like
I did not say
why
that.
I brought up.
I did not say that.
Maybe, okay, a lesser.
I thought it was an overlooked Coen brothers film. Not
overlooked,
a, yeah,
overlooked.
Not a lesser.
Not a lesser. I'm not gonna say. Yeah, maybe lesser is too harsh, but in the same way that I think like some of the overlooked of like Scorsese's catalog is like. Not the like supreme heights where you're like, God fucking damn it. Like, this is just like pure hype,
mm-hmm.
but like something where you're like, ooh, okay, this is good shit.
Right,
like,
right.
There is a moment, you know, I'd say the last 40 minutes of this movie,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking of it less as like relation to other masters classics and more where I was like, who is this, Yeezus? I think this might be Yeezus.
But I like, as far as catalog, I like...
That's what I mean. I don't think it's a bad comparison. Yeah. I think that this might be Yeezus, though,
yeah.
where it's like mostly funny. Genius. You're trying to do something different.
That's really good.
Like, you're trying to do something real specific.
Right.
You're stripping it down intentionally to go for a really interesting aesthetic.
Right.
And there's some choices in the latter half
pretty...
where I'm like... I really wanted you to earn those, but I don't think that you did. Like, I think that this movie is...
I remember the kettle or the track list. I'm having a hard time recalling that there's a song right after, like, Bound 2 that I can't exactly remember what it was, but right around there is where you kind of like...
Right. Where you're like, ooh, oh, man. kind of losing the thread here.
Pretty good.
This
may be the only podcast in which you're going to get that. I like the pool, though. I really do.
But I think this is another thing I wrote down while you were talking in your intro, where this is a neo, or not even a neo-noir, but a noir where the corruption is like classic American values, like classic American dream.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the crime is coming from, you know, within the house.
Yeah.
It's his like hunger and loneliness that's crippling. And I will disagree that it's a middle age like eight crisis thing, because I think that this is something that you see now.
Wait, you said you agree or disagree? I apologize.
I disagree.
You disagree.
Because I think that like currently you see the same, like, grifters preying on lonely adolescent men
mm-hmm.
with your, like, Andrew Tates and
Manosphere
looks maxing bullshit. Like that, yeah, too. All your, like, well, like, even the next generation, like, the generation after Joe Rogan, like, you're, like, looks maxing live streamer douchebag kids.
Your Aiden Ross's.
Like, yeah. Like, those are the guys that are the Tollivers.
Mm.
And okay. The young men that are being, like, falling prey to this are your Billy Bobs. Where it's like, no, they're kind of dumbasses doing this to themselves. And, like, there's a point where you have to feel sorry for them because they're obviously being preyed on. But then also it's like, sometimes you just talk themselves into it where you're like, ah, man, every time you fuck this up, it's like, yeah, you had this coming, dumbass.
Mm. Like, a pass.
Like, but
you're way out of line, mister.
I mean, that was honestly the most interesting part where I was like, even that Billy Bob picked up on that. I was like, oh, that sounds like maybe there's a reason he's got a sexless marriage. Maybe this is going, this is all starting to become clearer there. And he's like, No, I'm not into it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. You picked up on that signal better than I did.
Really? That's like, interesting. Cause I thought it was pretty clear with the lean back and wink, but also my mind didn't go that.
Oh, maybe I didn't catch the wink.
Oh, yeah, he winks in it. Yeah. So he leans back and he winks. That's why he, at least, I don't know, you have a weird thing with winks that you've brought up in the past of this podcast. But I've seen, go back.
What?
It's an interesting little wink. But I'm curious, so the Scarlett Johansson and his dynamic, that didn't ring to you, is maybe that's where the desire is kind of funneling itself into? Oh, I guess we're a little too early in the film for that to kind of, you're in your mind at that point. I got you.
Yeah, exactly. You're getting it. But speaking of the Scarlett Johansson thing, like, I think just doesn't pay off enough to justify its existence.
Mm.
Like, we've talked about in comedy a bunch of, like, you can tell the most offensive joke that you want if you make it funny enough. Like, the more out of line it is, the funnier it's got to be to justify its existence. And, like, with a good enough pen, you can get away with some crazy shit. And, like, I don't think that this movie gets, like, I don't think this movie makes enough of a point to get away with the last 40 minutes.
I'm going to disagree, but I'm going to also save. I don't know if it's worth. Maybe I'll just say this briefly. The midlife crisis and how it shows itself throughout history with the, you know, you get the fast car. You start dating your secretary, like the way that he tries to funnel that into a noir, and his version of that is a dry cleaning business, and this 15-year-old whatever girl that he knows from one of his that kind of, it works for me in terms of the, you know, like the midlife crisis bit of it, but I can I'm not gonna invalidate that response because I do think that's the most extraneous part. Like, that kind of going out and we won't need to spoil it here, but that little section of the storyline, please, yeah, it feels like you have something you want to follow up with it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't want to cut you off. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. I just wanted, like, I think that I don't want it to sound like I didn't like this movie at all, too, because I think it's, especially on my second watch, I found myself like being just like, damn, this really is a banger. Mm-hmm. Like, every shot looks fucking gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Every side character is hilarious. Like,
yeah, oh my God.
The writing is sharp as hell. It's so fucking consistently funny. And there's parts of it that are fairly predictable and obvious. But it's also doing something somewhat interesting in the way that I think, like, if you liked Burn After Reading and if you liked A Serious Man, you can see the stepping stone that this movie was to those other movies that I think each do a very different aspect of what this movie's doing in a more polished way, where I think is part of the reason why this is, like, more overlooked in their filmography.
I want to add to that stepping stone because I love what you say there, because I think there are direct parallels to those two films. The one that like gets them from here to there is Hudsucker Proxy, and I can't remember what scene it is, but apparently there's a barbershop poster of, like, you know, the executive contour, the junior contour, the blah, 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 blah. And they kept staring through that during production and then just started getting the ideas in their head about a barber that they wanted to write about. So that I think it's another one, the Hudsucker Proxy. Like, there's a direct, you know, I want to say it was like 30s in that film, but there's that direct challenge on the American dream and in getting mm-hmm. to the top spot and realizing, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, I like that there's a lot of little early Coen Brothers, you know, springboards into this film. Yeah. McGee, seen you so to get somebody to watch.
There's so many brilliant choices that I'm sure we're going to talk about more as the episode goes on.
Right.
But the scene that you, if you only could pick one scene to show me in particular, mm-hmm. To make me watch this movie, it's definitely Tony Shalhoub monologuing about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Where I was just amazing. Like, I mean, the whole time I was like, yeah, Eric's absolutely fucking right. Like, Tony Shalhoub was just on fire this yeah. whole fucking movie. And then that whole monologue where he's like staring up into the light and we're getting the like totally different looks with the contrast. Like, Deakins is just like spitting straight fire. Tony Shalhoub is just ascending to heaven. And it's just it's a perfect moment that is like one of those things where I'm like, this is for me. Like, they made this exists in the world. Because I wanted it to exist. This is for me.
I love Tony Shalhoub so much in this film. We're going to definitely cover it. And that scene in particular is a highlight. What I think I even like more is as he's doing the whole performative lawyer bit, when Billy Bob in the
thanks, now get lost.
No, to the cop.
Oh.
But no, yeah. Billy Bob in the
when he tells the private detective. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, you can. Oh. My bad, sorry. Yeah, so in
I just love the I love the. Sorry. You paused, and I thought you were waiting, so I was like, I jumped.
No, jump.
Oh, it'll be short. So I absolutely love when he says the get lost line because it implies some deeper relationship with his usual private detective.
Oh,
like that, he's mad at him about something. Like, the private detective definitely fucked something up that he's mad about because he's so bitchy and short with him that it's like they have a history, and it's obviously they have a history. He hires him all the time, so it's like you fucked up something.
Okay, so this is so interesting for 2 points, because where I took it as Tony Shalhoub is being more of the type A personality, and because he tells Billy Bob immediately when he meets him, like, you know, you're not a lawyer, I'm a lawyer, like, you know, what do you know, you're Shalhoub, whatever the bit is, and
yeah.
And, like, so I didn't read it as that they had a prior, but that is a really funny take on that, to imagine that.
Because he's so short with him.
Yeah, that is a really funny take to bring up. But I do know he's from Sacramento, and this is Santa Rosa. Like, we're like, you know, Tony Shalhoub is supposed to be like a hotshot lawyer from a big city, big town.
Okay, yeah.
But I do like the I don't know, the wider reading, the what could be your own personal lore, what could be going on there. My scene, I love this scene so goddamn much, and it's the Catherine Berwitz scene, and this is Ann Nerdlinger, who's actually like, so what makes this so amazing is, one, we meet this character and she doesn't speak at all, and so we get to know her and her performance through her, you know, her facial acting, her eyes, her little body, like, we're gonna talk about your shot a little later on in the episode, but her little body movements and how rigid and right angled they get, even with how she like when she turns her head,
yeah.
Her eyes are on a pin point, and she like can't move her head without like turning her eyes in the same direction.
That's what, so I've learned from Natalie what she's in is called a wiggle dress, because it's like you can't move your hips except to like just wiggle.
Oh, is that what?
That's how she has to move around. So it's a wiggle dress. But I absolutely love that she like you said, like locks her head orientation in with it. So it's she's just so robotic and weird. It's so fun.
Her scene of talking about Big Dave and their alien experience is gold. Everything about the sound design, her performance, the timing, like her like looking off to the left and just like holding it like every few seconds and like looking back and like addressing the conversation. Her like saying the government and like outside of wherever the place was. I think she steals. You know, who's please.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was going to say, she reminds me of fucking, like, her, comedically, the instincts of, like, Bryan Cranston.
Interesting.
Like, that, like, that where it's, like, it could be really serious, but there's, like, also such just, like, hilarious choices played straight. Like, the look off, like, she's, right? Like... is a like I could see Bryan Cranston doing that in a scene, like, and like it's a strange comparison to make, but I think it works for me for some reason.
Two for two with the with the Yeezus and Bryan Cranston. so yeah, I love this reminds me so much of like Pee Wee's Big Adventure, Large Marge scene where it's just like these two characters and this creepy story between the two of them, and it's just this music, this haunting music in the background. I absolutely need to turn lights on. I've seen this, like I said, this is my maybe three or four times that I'm watching this. I still get uncomfortable at the end of the scene, knowing it's a comedy, knowing it's got this movie, but just the delivery of it, and there's like her, you know, the veil.
I need
lighting.
To remember.
Yeah.
I need to remember this moment anytime I'm thinking about making you watch a movie and I'm going, that's not too scary. He can take that. I'm going to remember this exact moment where you're like, I had to turn the lights on for the spooky UFO scene that Sean just compared to Malcolm in the Middle.
But it's creepy. It's very unsettling. And I think it's very well performed by Catherine. And then Billy Bob is just a stalwart, like, straight man, and throughout this entire film, selling those looks, selling, like, just come in, Ann, like, just come inside, or whatever the dialogue is. Beautiful scene, love this, and it tonally, I think, sells some of, like, what you were saying about taking this so seriously as a performer, as an actor, like, she can really sell this, but have that edge, like, that knowing comedy to it, so, yeah, this is the highlight of the film to me. one of my favorite scenes in the film. And we'll move forward to the opening of the film coming up after this.
Welcome back from the break. We're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film. Starting with the start, as always, with that big bang. It's the opening sizzle or fizzle. I don't know why I got so hype on this one. I don't even...
I love it. I love the energy.
But what do you think about the opening of this one? It's pretty.
So I think we've had a few films now where the voiceover we've been on either sides of. I think it works immediately for me because I love the baritone of Billy Bob's voice. I love the delivery of the writing is sharp. The delivery is sharper. He has this.
I would have gone the opposite.
Is that again?
I agree with you, but I would have flipped them, but yes.
You would have flipped sardonic and...
No, yeah. I would have flipped the delivery is sharp, but the writing is sharper.
Oh, the writing is sharper? Okay, I see what you're saying.
I'm not like super in love with Billy Bob.
Really? That surprises me.
I think he's got an amazing face for Deacons to Light.
Yeah.
And he's just serving nothing... Which is what he's being asked to. Like, he's meant to be
clearly.
Blank. Mm-hmm. Like, just a thoughtless, instinctionary douchebag. So, like, just looking like a wannabe, like, looks-maxing influencer is, like, exactly... I think he works perfectly for that.
Back in the 40s. Right?
That's what I think. He's the OG looks-maxer. But I think the voiceover that he's doing is even feeding into that, where it's like, it feels in character for him to be intentionally trying to sound cool. Like, even in the point later,
intentionally trying to sound cool, like that feels like there's the choice to lower.
So
the
that's
That's
what I think that both Billy Bob is making the choice to lower his voice, but I think the Coen brothers are using it as a device because. Even the, like, noir framing of this movie as a whole, I think, is a look... This isn't a story that is that much different from any other Coen brothers story at its core. Like, on paper, this isn't much different from Raising Arizona, and it's not much different from Burn After Reading if you just broke it into its, like, base colors.
A screwball comedy of...
Like, shot very, very well. The stakes keep escalating. Mm-hmm. it's mostly funny, but at times the intensity of the escalating stakes kind of start to overlap with the comedy in a way where you're like, this doesn't feel like a comedy anymore. Like, there's dark. Things have gotten a little dark. So I think that all that same DNA is there. And so the really, really straightforward noir, like pastiche, like the noir aesthetic, especially with him doing the voiceover too, is like this self-made image that he has for himself that he's built up, where he has dreams of being more important than he is. And so the way he views his rather mundane life is that of an adventurer, and the kinds of stories that he reads are probably noir stories. So this is like his internal monologue is like, he's basically doing the Calvin and Hobbes thing, but grown up and sad.
That's so interesting. I completely disagree, like almost 100%. Like I think that's some galaxy brain take on how this character views himself in a way that...
Do you know the Calvin and Hobbes strips that I'm talking about? Doing the noir.
Exactly,
yeah.
What you're talking about. I don't feel he's that self-observant for a number of reasons. I don't think he really truly... Like, he has an idea of things he wants, and like you mentioned, he's instinctual. He'll make really impulsive moves here. I don't find him to be that self-aware to where he's going to change the baritone of his voice to suit a fucking Men's Monthly ad that he's seeing, and like that's probably how that guy talks. You know what I mean? Like, I want to do it. That just doesn't seem like the character for me. But I will agree to a certain extent that Ed is like kind of searching for identity, and even with his relationship with Birdie, it gets weird because you're not sure if he's into her, like he wants to sleep with her, or if he wants to manage her. And I'm not even sure he really knows. Like it feels like when she is gonna give him head, like as they're driving, it kind of feels like that's what he's. We're justifying that, you know, through the through this talent, you know, show and trying to and spending night after night with her. You know what I mean? It's like that's a justification for kind of, you know, wanting to spend some time with her. So it's this weird thing where he's going after things he wants so haphazardly. Like I said, this is midlife crisis that he's having right now. So he's kind of, you know, he's on the edge. His job sucks. His wife sucks. He sees an opportunity for dry cleaning to be the way out. Hits a crossroads. And then this is kind of the last resort until he eventually crashes out. And then he's jailed for a crime he didn't commit. It feels like he's a little bit more haphazard and just kind of just doing things like a dog chasing his tail, and a little less manicured in the way that I'm going to dress and you know, he's in the grooming business, so he's a very manicured man, but I'm not going to do these things in an effort to come across as more cool than I am. I think that's a little bit more of a vanity take for that character than I think Ed's getting off.
But it's the vanity that makes him pursue the dry cleaning, get rich quick scheme.
But he lets somebody else
name.
So that
he can have,
like, you can be taller. Like Tolliver's a vanity character.
He wants the money and status to make his wife pay attention to him. But it's still, you know, vanity at its core. I hear what you're saying. I'm not like saying you're wrong, but I do think like it the
you're
what
wrong,
you're
no.
saying what I'm saying.
Just so we're clear here.
Well, what I'm saying that I don't the re- your reasoning for it I don't think is incompatible with my view of it.
I just don't get vanity for this character at all. Like I don't get the manicured I'm trying to be cooler than I am from this character at all. Like it seems like he's the man who wasn't there. He's the opposite of that. Like I'm trying to disappear. Or you know what? Maybe I'm upset that I am so undefined and I am so vacant, and I have really not a lot going on that I thought I would. That I'm trying to make these extensions to have that sort of vanity. Maybe I can extend you that. But I don't read this character.
Yeah, I would say this is the one time that he steps out.
Yeah,
you know he. for a moment tries to become someone.
Right.
Well, it's like, well, yeah, it's like he's no one. He's the man who wasn't there.
Right.
He meets this grifter, sees an opportunity, steps out for a second, ends up killing Big Dave. And it's like, whoa, that went fucking terribly.
Yeah.
Like, that went fucking terribly. Somehow I got away with it. Everything's right. Chill. Immediately it's like, I'm going to start flirting with this 15-year-old. Right. Then, like, you know, uh-oh. Like, yeah, like, wife gets arrested.
Right, right.
It's like, all right, let me try.
You know, we've all been there.
But it is very much a, like, he keeps... You know, stepping out, hitting a tragedy, retreating,
mm-hmm.
you know, being more unhappy. He, like, talks about, like, you know, the one monologue he has halfway through his movie at his low point or whatever, where he does right. the whole I'm a ghost line.
Yeah.
And I think it is a great, like, summation of his character in the movie or whatever. But that is the, like, kind of tug of war back and forth that he's having of, like, anytime he tries to be someone,
right.
he gets knocked back down to remind him that he's a piece of shit.
Do you let's go out on this priest Buddhist for this segment. I like that you brought us there. Character judgment, piece of shit. Do you feel Ed's like I have a little bit of sympathy for Ed. I guess my priest Buddhist question walking out of the film. Do you really judge Ed as harshly as you do based on the American dream he was sold, based on his wife, you know, stepping out on him? And that's the other thing, like, she's pregnant. Like, we find out later in the film that him and
yeah.
Dave, you know, were going to had a child. Obviously, the Scarlett Johansson shit is a little weird, but do you really blame Dave for trying to be the master of his own domain, his destiny. Like, let me try to fuck this guy, and if my wife's gonna step on him, I'm gonna take $10,000 and then try to, you know, remake my life a bit. Why can we blame? Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not saying he takes all the blame, but I'm not gonna be dumb enough to put my name on anybody in particular here. But I'm just gonna say there have been famous spats where. It's like, yeah, both these people suck. Like, there's no good guy or bad guy here. It's just, like, two people that suck that are bad to each other. And I think that's pretty much the case here of, like, yes, I think Ed is an absolute piece of fucking garbage. I think that, you know, anytime he has any initiative, it's a bad instinct. And so he's rewarded with having zero initiative, and then he wants you to be like, woe is me, I'm not given any opportunity. And it's like, well, yeah, anytime you have an opportunity, you make a poor choice. So, like, you know, I'm not saying don't make choice.
Let me stand up for Ed for a little bit. You've been working same job 10 years, or longer than that. I can't remember what he says in the first few minutes of the film. You've been doing this dead-end job forever.
If that's what he looks like after doing it 10 years. I mean, again, this is from the era of fucking lead cigarettes, but...
And he's smoking them constantly throughout this film. you know,
just
like
ripping
said,
them...
You're...
Ripping them, just dipping it in the fucking, like, Barbasol, like, cleaner.
Like, I've seen you in your fur coat. You understand midlife crisis just as well as Ed does. Like you understand when you get to a point where it's just like things have bubbled over. I'm older than what I thought I was. You know, everything's kind of rushing at me fast. Where am I going?
A girl at work told me I dress like a private detective on vacation.
So if anyone would be sensitive to Ed's plight here, I thought it would be you.
Fuck. No, fuck this dude.
All right, well, I'm going to stack up for at least Billy Bob's performance.
Fuck.
Coming up in our Under the Lights segment after this. All right, welcome back from break. We're going Under the Lights, breaking down performances, talking about the best ones up top. Obviously, I pitched this episode with Shaloub. We sung a little bit of his praises earlier. But I think he's just, you know, to continue singing his praise, I think he's just phenomenal in this role as Reed Schneider, the hotshot lawyer from Sacramento.
Incredible.
Where he's having, Cohen sort of explained it in the commentary of the Criterion edition of this DVD that I suggest you guys get if you're able, where he's like, he has a term that I fucking hate, but that main character energy, to where even the moves of like Francis McDormand getting committing suicide, like how he performs that, of like he's disappointed he can't continue with the case, and is like, he's like sighing really big and like walking over to the desk and like closing up his laptop, like, or his briefcase, and not even addressing his client first to say like what's going on. You know, it's like
he's in the season finale of a TV show where like he looks over his shoulder and the studio audience goes, oh.
Exactly. And that's what it feels. He's so talented in this part. Like I love and this is where, I don't want to be the dig here and try to bring up the thing that happened last week, but we were talking Contact and I was bringing up, you know, Jodie Foster, like I can feel her, she has a lot of dialogue granted, but I feel some of like her rushing through it, or not taking the emotive pauses that make it sort of feel real a little bit. I have no problem with that from Shalhoub here. And I think, I mean, the scene we picked out, the uncertainty principle, and like him sort of like the way he stumbles.
But he's a lawyer. He's monologuing. Like,
yeah, but I believe the monologue. In where I'm like in certain ways, I'm hearing the the repetition, almost like I'm hearing, like I can feel, like it doesn't, it feels rehearsed. Some of it feels rehearsed in that one. That I was trying to get across, like where this one, I'm just like, feels so fucking natural in the way Tony kind of gets that across. Absolutely love him in this one. Polito is god tier. Big Lebowski,
incredible.
Love him in there, but here, like Polito is almost god tier in this.
He's always good, but yeah, he's just is like so effortless in this that it's incredible.
Him taking off,
even as a corpse, the corpse is even great.
Yeah, the facial expression at the end of that. They pull. I mean, him sweating about. So how he casually counts, and this is the other thing, the degree of difficulty of him performing as he's counting the money, he's giving the 10,000, he's having like da 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 da, and he has to end the line on the whatever the two bills that he's going to do. That all, he sings through that, and then when he like takes his hands and then just puts like how he just kind of rests at the end of that, like every like the lawyer bit, like I insist, get a lawyer, and then like stopping to do the vanity thing again, so you're okay if it's called Tolliver's. It's like his highs, yeah, the shuckster, snakes oil salesman, like it was so, oh my god, Polito's fantastic.
He also, to like, because I think what I hear what you're saying for sure about the Shalhoub versus Jody, and I think I still see like Shalhoub is obviously playing like not just a lawyer, but a top-notch lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
So his entire, like his character should be able to make everything sound natural, even if it's something that he's thought up ahead of time. This is something that he's, you know, should be effortlessly doing. Whereas Jodie Foster's character is a scientist who is like going to have had rehearsed this speech to give to people previously.
Yeah. You mentioned so that like in the
it, those all fit with me for sure, but. To bring it back here, though, I think Polito effortlessly does what's better than either of those, mm-hmm. which is he can flip between the two without it. Is that he sounds like he's like energetic and excited, and obviously, right. like, you know, you got the fucking dough. And like, and then he flips into salesman, like, where he's like, you know, go get a lawyer. I insist. Like, he's obviously said those words before. But the flipping between the two voices sounds so natural and perfect that it's just like, oh my god, like so
how
good.
How he flips between those personalities, and I think it's performed through the toupee, and I want to bring up the example of when Billy Bob first enters the room, or when he first goes to the hotel. Motel, wherever he's in, and he knocks, and he's like, you know, I was the barber, you know, I cut your hair today. And just the way he's like, he's being friendly, but he's not putting it together. He's like, I don't really remember you, or why I thought you were the porter. Why are you here? And immediately when he realizes, you know, I'm interested in the investment that you were talking about, and like snaps into that mode by like putting on the toupee.
Yeah, he's got to suit up. He's got to put on the costume.
Right.
Even though he's already seen through the veneer, like he's seen behind the curtain.
Right.
He knows it's not a real wizard. He's like, no, I need this for me.
Right. It makes the yeah, and that's so wow. That is really interesting because there is sort of a admission or a acknowledgement that the Emperor has no clothes that he has to do.
Yeah.
With somebody, but then he's still, for whatever reason, he's still going to perform it anyway. Like, it still gives him the confidence to do it anyway.
It's so fucking good.
That's a bit I hadn't necessarily considered with that. I wanted to move into Best Line Reese because it kind of goes into the Shalhoub bit that we were talking about, of him being the performative thing. But it's him doing the performative thing, and I think it kind of turns Ed, who we've kind of, you know, we've seen as this laconic, dour, or at least blank kind of man, where he's sort of admiring Tony Shalhoub a little bit in, like, his speech, where he goes, like, he says it, it's a pretty good speech, but the line that I love is where he goes, like, he said, look at the words, but then look at the meaning of the words, but then he said the words had no meaning. Like that back to back is incredible. I may cut into this one because he's delivering better than I did, but his whole bit of like describing Tony Shalhoub's performance in the courtroom, and just sort of admiring it just a little bit. Like, he's like, man, you know, it wasn't bad.
It's funny too. They like. That comes in the movie after all of the scenes of Tony Shalhoub, like, repeatedly just hitting it out of the park, being this, like, fucking incredible character.
Right.
And so, but when he gets to that point where he's describing the defense that he puts on, you can hear him doing it in your own head. Like, you know, like, you can kind of imagine it already, because he's established himself so well. It's so fucking good. The line I want to bring up, and because we have to talk about Frances McDormand, absolute fucking,
oh, yeah,
like, powerhouse, like, brilliant,
yeah,
powerhouse, absolutely. Yeah. Two of my favorite lines are both hers. The congratulations on your goddamn cherries.
Yeah.
Is so fucking funny. The messy bitch energy of that fucking, yeah, just, congratulations on your goddamn cherries. It's so good. And, like, she does just brilliant work with her face, just with these incredible
glasses, like, just off her nose as she's singing in that scene. And she's, like, dipping down and, like, walking back with it. It's just, like, yeah, absolutely.
She is so fucking good in this movie. I mean, she's great in everything. But this is one of the, like, the collaboration is just singing right here. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is when she just yells, Jesus Christ, at the other prisoner who's, like, having a mental breakdown.
Oh, yeah, the girl down there, yeah.
The girl's, like, sobbing and crying, right. And she just fucking, like, just yells Jesus Christ, like, just get your shit together. And it's, oh, my God,
she's,
I love her so much.
One. There's not a incredible bad performance in this one. I mean, really quick, just Richard Jenkins, the work he does with his head when he first meets him on the porch and he's like drinking on the porch, but he's like, he can't like stay awake. He's like all every muscle is just trying to hold his head up for this conversation. But there's a point when he loses it, and just the sound design of him like banging his head on the chair, but then like picking it back up and it like rotates around and then finishing his line. Well, it's just genius.
I know I've done that. I know I've seen other people do that. I won't call you out. I know you're listening. I'm going to text you about this.
Oh, so many great performances in this one. So many great lines.
You know who? Another one I want to bring up, and I have a little game to play afterwards.
Nice.
But even Scarlett Johansson, she could have been playing this way more Lolita and, like, right, scandalous. So,
yeah.
And her not really doing that much, like, kind right. of being pretty straight with it, like, I found interesting. Like, it was.
Yeah.
And it made that plot line.
By that. They even at her age, because she was eating sunflower seeds in the bedroom scene, and they're like, oh, we like that. can you do that in the scene? And she's like, no, why would I do that? And what she says to them is like, I'm not going to do that, but I'll give you what you like about that. Or I'll give you what I think you like about that.
Oh,
and so,
shit.
And this is her at like 15. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, 15, like, 16, yeah, that's like, nuts.
Yeah, fucking, yeah. She so, command.
Those. On that note, I've always had a soft spot for good old ScarJo.
Okay.
Because at the ripe old age of 23, she made a music album that was one original track and 10 covers of one particular artist.
Artist? Okay, I was going to say, yeah. A bunch of artists.
So your multiple choice here is which artist was ScarJo? Did ScarJo basically do a cover of, a cover album of, when she was 23? I think this was 2008. She recorded it in 2007.
Did it come out, like, was it available for, like, or was it one of these things like Hollywood lore or something like that? Like, you could hear.
No. I remember listening to it.
Okay. All right,
I remember listening to it when it came out because I had like a lot of respect for her, just for this album alone. And like she's, like I said, she's always had kind of a soft spot for me. So is this this, the name of the album's Anywhere I Lay My Head, which is a clue, but I guarantee you don't get it. So I don't mind giving it to you.
Fuck you.
So
what,
is
what
this?
What are my answers? I don't get it.
Your options are A, Tom Waits. B, David Bowie. Okay. C, Neil Young. Or D, Led Zeppelin.
I want to go Bowie or Zepp. What was it? Anywhere I Lay My Head?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say... What is she... I wish I knew what these represent in the white world. Like what kind of status, symbol, whatever. If I like this person. Like, you brought
like, you know
Jesus
who David
example.
Bowie is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that's a more artistic person. But I'm not sure how people see Zeppelin. If he's, like, grunge but artistic and sort of creative. And
I
like,
mean,
like, what it says about you as a person. Like, I could see you. I could see her saying I like. But I'm not sure if I'm that esoteric and sort of hard, difficult to read. Or if I'm more easily digestible, kind of commercial Zeppelin, how I think they are in the white world. Like, I don't really know. Because I don't really listen to either, so I'm not really sure. But just by lore, I know by legend. So I'm gonna say she
just skipped over Neil Young out of pure.
So
I'm not
know,
really
I don't
familiar
know,
with Neil
yeah,
Young's
I don't know
game.
Neil Young, like,
yeah,
he's more like country.
That's fair. No. I kind of expected that, but no, Neil Young is like more like folk, I would say. I mean, it definitely like roots in country, but not country as you're thinking about it. Like, Neil Young is definitely like straight up left wing, like activist folk music.
The fact that you got a little sensitive that I didn't consider him, I'm wondering if that may be pointing me towards the right answer there.
No, I was just think, I was just giggling.
Answer. B. Bowie
David
for
Bowie.
The win. Bowie for the win.
David Bowie for the sad consolation prize.
Oh, really?
So David Bowie did actually feature on the album and does add vocals to two tracks.
Okay.
So you're not wrong to think that he might have been included, but the album was in fact 10 covers of Tom Waits tracks, which
I didn't even get to. What, Tom Waits, isn't he more like, all right, hold on.
Tom Waits is like haunted clown. Oh, sorry.
Let me just tell you what I think Tom Waits is. Is he like yacht rock? Like, is he like yacht rock, like mimosa kind of, like, that's what I get when I hear Tom Waits.
Oh my God, no! You couldn't be more wrong. You know who Tom Waits is, right?
No. Tom Waits, Robbie.
You put on Tom Waits. He's in Book of Eli. He's the weird old merchant guy
that sells the battery. That's right. And you brought him up. Help me out with the.
He's
music.
Also,
I know the name. Help me out with the music.
So Tom
I don't
Waits,
know his vibe.
Tom Waits
like
is
that.
A legendary. He's like it's also folk music, but it's like. train tracks, like whiskey and cigarettes and haunted clowns.
Like he's in
folk
Jim
music.
Beam commercial kind of shit.
Oh no! If anybody uses anything that even sounds remotely like a Tom Waits song, he sues the shit out of them, and that's how he makes a lot of his money. Because people are constantly ripping off his songs for commercials, and he will prove it in court that they are copying him, and just sue the absolute shit out of him instead of ever licensing his music.
All right, moving on to Best Fit. We're going to credit Dennis Gosner, costume designer here. I got a funny one. You do as well. Let me pull up yours as I stall.
These are both fits that are out of my closet as I'm speaking of midlife crisis. As I find my shape getting rounder and me trying to decide how to dress. I can look to this movie in a couple of options and go, yeah, you know, I can go down that route.
What I think is so fascinating about shooting in black and white, we talked a little bit about Deacons. We're going to talk a little bit more in our next segment. But I've stressed over and over in talking about this when we brought up, I can't even think of the Peter Sellers' It's a Wonderful Life take from our December year that Nat had us put on. Great film, but that one shot in black and white. I brought it up there.
The only thing my brain could do was It's a Christmas.
No, see, for whatever I remember your I always remember the alt titles. I think your alt title was like it was the something Vietnam, or was the Wake Up It's Vietnam.
Oh, Happy Christmas War is over.
Yeah, Happy Christmas
War. It's a John Lennon.
Right.
Because it's a John Lennon song.
Yeah, it was a lyric. There you go, sorry. I remember title for that. Yeah, but I don't remember the title for the film.
That's so funny that we do that.
Or half remembered the alt title. I knew it was like a lyric or something like that. It was a Beatles or, I guess, a John Lennon song. Joe threw in there. But anyway, I bring these up in these black and white films to re-emphasize that texture and texture is a big part of, you know, not only the canvas that you're going to paint with using these tones, using it for separation, using it for, you know, contrast, using it to kind of create that three-dimensionality in a shape. I love the use of pattern in this as well. So the his shirt with these little white sort of, I'm not sure, right, crosses or whatever like that, that are pattern. And I think is Betaluco? Is this the brother?
Yeah, Frankie.
That they run into with the pie, or they make him they make him do the blueberry pie eating contest. I love this shirt in black and white. It's a little more contemporary than I think sometimes I'm thinking about in the 40s. But this whole picture, like, feels, by picture, this whole film feels like it could be, it's like, it feels like it's just in line with the, you know, the 20, 30, 40 classic noirs of the Fox lot, yeah. The Columbia lot, Universal lot of its day, but just kissed a little bit more with a buttery tone from Deacons. Do you know what I mean? Like the image looks right in a way that I don't think other black and white films sometimes that like try to ape this like period or try to recreate this look. Sometimes it looks a little too sharp, like you'll mention some of the lenses. People don't kind of take back that sharpness, so it feels a little too modern in a way. Like, I like the way that there's a smoothness to the image, but it still feels a little extra. Like it feels like it can belong back in the day, but I can still feel it still feels of its time, like of 2001.
You know what's funny about that? I think, like, for me, I had I think we're both looking at the same thing, but I had the kind of opposite read on it.
Interesting.
Where it's very, like, it shows you how fucking good, like, modern film stock is, or I guess modern, you know, 20 years ago film stock. But just, like, the technology of, like, silver emulsion into film has gotten so improved that, like, this movie, obviously in the hands of one of the greatest cinematographers in history, Roger Deakins, like, a lot of movies that imitate noir, like you're saying, go for a really heavy contrast ratio and, like, really, really, really crunch down the shadows into, like, pure black. where this movie's really leaning into the density of the film stock and like really letting the dynamic range like sing. So the scene that at the bar where the detective tells him that like Frances McDormand was pregnant, their coroner, faces are fully or coroner, sorry. But they're Billy Bob's face is 100% silhouetted, but you can still see his eyes. Like, you can still make out just enough detail to see his face, like his facial expression. Like, and there's pure black in the scene. It's not just that like all the shadows are lifted. It's just like his face is just like as much of a hair above completely underexposed as you could get and still make out detail. Like, Deakins is showing you the full latitude of this. Like, what 35mm film can do in the early 2000s. Like, this is the full fucking latitude of this black and white film. And so I think it's interesting that you find it authentic to the period. Because I think the more that people try to emulate the film stocks of the time, the less it looks like it's authentic.
Because
it looks more like you're trying to imitate it and less like you're using the film to its full extent, which they would have been using the film to its full extent. The film just didn't have wasn't as advanced at the time, but the lighting was still as good.
And I agree. I think I just want to, I wholeheartedly agree that trying to chase that look, you're going to get further away from it. And if I'm understanding what you're saying, Deakins just taking full advantage of what he has here, not being afraid. When you're saying that he makes the latitude of the stock kind of sing, is he embracing sort of the mid-tones? Is that a way that – can you help me identify what you mean exactly?
Yeah.
Like, he's not afraid of things looking a little less contrasty, like a little more gray, a little bit more flat in some areas, or help me understand what he's doing in the latitude that's a little different.
Because it's just very specifically sculpted so that like you could have something that's like very contrasty, but if you still want to get detail in your shadows, you just kind of bring the shadows up uniformly. But this is sculpted very specifically with mostly with placement on set and less with, you know, color grade, where there are parts of the frame that are going to pure black. But if he wants you to be able to see the emotion in the scene, the face is going to be like just a stop above, just even a half stop above. So that just enough above that, like, you're getting a tiny bit of detail, but low enough that it's still like contributing to the mood of the scene overall. And overall in the frame, you're getting the full like Ansel Adams fucking, you know, full range of like brightest thing in the scene, and like each step along down the way, like the whole frame is painted so that you have the full variety of like luminance values. But everything is very specifically placed instead of like just getting a grade on where you're like slapping a curve on your post-production and like adding that like contrasty crunch in post. Like, no, this is sculpted with intention on set with like lighting placement more than anything else.
And I feel like based on some of the commentary, Deakins has a great bit on the Criterion DVD. I strongly suggest everyone grab it if able, where he mentions sculpted, but it's still simple. Like, there's still very I'm not sure what simplicity that means for Deakins. Or, you know, what in his mind reads as simple, but I want to take him at his word that it feels like
I mean, it's usually, I mean, I've studied Deakins and
yeah, please,
been
please.
A pale imitation for most of my career was my like go-to moneymaker. So, I mean, I can tell you exactly what I assume he means by sculpted but simple.
Right.
Because it's something that I spent my career imitating. Is usually it's either one main light source or like a very, very limited number of lights. Like, but usually like one direction, one light source. You know, you're going to have multiple light sources, but they got to be coming from, like, pretty distinct directions at that point.
Right.
And then just sculpting that in with controlling devices. Mm-hmm. But you're doing one big soft source and then a lot of little sculpts in between to, like, mm-hmm. very... Almost at that point, like, you're, like, loading... if you've ever lit, like, tiny objects for, like, you know, like, magazine photography mm-hmm. or anything.
Mm-hmm. They're Product using...
Yeah, you call it. They call them dots and fingers, where it's a bunch of like little circle or oval shaped, like black or white or gray blobs, and you kind of put them. You can put them kind of just off camera so that they're like giving you shapes and reflections. So you're basically like if you have a curvy object that's dark and you want to shoot it on a dark background. The only thing that you can see the geometry of the object at that point is in its reflections. Mm-hmm. Like, actually lighting it isn't going to really do any good. Because if you just use one big light, you're just going to see one big light. Mm-hmm. So you end up putting, like, a bunch of little tiny little circles and tiny little ovals and just, like, weird little flags that are just mm-hmm. getting in between the light source and the reflections.
Flags
just
or lights?
Little flags. Like, they're not okay. light sources. They're okay, just okay. little... Yeah. Little things to block the light,
right.
And that's what's mostly shaping the reflections and the objects that you see.
I see what you're saying. So we're just gonna sculpt like this one big light, this one big soft source.
Yeah,
we're gonna try to create the shapes out of that.
And you're really, really dialing in every little pocket,
right.
Out of sculpting out little pieces of it.
Yeah.
But the object of it is just one big source.
I love it. Speaking of one big source, you got let's go out on the one big best fit you had. With the,
oh my God, are we still in best fit? Jesus yes. Christ. Were we not talking about lighting? I thought we had moved on so long ago. Anyway, sorry. yeah. Like I said, this is mostly just me scoping out future fits. And I was like, yeah, I can do this look. I could get a little lounger, just just dismiss people.
Right.
This would be me if I ever got a higher up position. I'm just sitting in my office on a chaise lounge, like. You don't have what it takes. Get the fuck out of here. You don't have the spark, kid.
Play the notes too perfect.
I can't teach you jazz. You bland bitch. Get this white bread bitch ass.
I hear the HR complaints coming already. Let's move on to more of the film's look. Because, like I said, this is a big... I think some of the first impression when watching this film is how gorgeous it is. So, looking forward to talking about Deacon's work coming up after this.
All right, welcome back from the break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and curtain close. You can follow along this segment through a link in the show notes to our Patreon, where we got a free post where you can see our favorite shots from this film. You don't have to sign up to see it, but we'd like it if you did. Sign up, shoot us a little message with your address, and get some stuff from Uncle Lance's private stash. For now, let's talk about the shots in this fucking movie. Obviously, done by the one, the only, one of the biggest influences on my career, Roger motherfucking Deakins. This film is fucking incredible. Like, just every single shot is gorgeous. Every single shot is immaculately lit. First shot I want to talk about is from literally 9 minutes in, when we're being introduced to Ed in the barbershop. This is, I think, after we've already been introduced, and we're just seeing him kind of sweep up at the end of the first day that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we got, this just is such a good classic noir. And this is what we were talking about earlier, too, where, like, the dark side of his face isn't fully crunched down to black. But you still have, you know, the barber accoutrement on the shelf there and, like, behind the cash register.
Right.
Like there's darker element. There's the full, you know, gamut here, but you got the classic noir tropes of your Venetian blinds and your, you know, kind of contrasty lighting, but not out of element for a barbershop either. Like, finding a middle ground where we're really committing to the bit here, but not just going like full Sin City on it or something.
Yeah. Great shot. Love this. I love to. Since, I mean, the barbershop is largely white, so the floor, the walls, the schmucks, there is sort of this cleanliness. I don't know if that's the right word for it. This sort
yeah.
of, clinical isn't the right word.
Sterility.
Yeah. There's a peacefulness kind of to where like even the shot where we get the extreme close up of him like sweeping up the hair, there's this like angelic sort of quality,
like
of
a zen
light. Yeah,
that's so interesting, because I was definitely reading it as more of a like artificial sterile, like the way a hospital smells.
I think that's a great read on it as well, because like I think he feels more like that about his profession than I'm selling how, you know, it's
yeah.
giving off. You know what I mean? Like,
oh God, that
aesthetic about this. Say it again.
That weird bit that he has where he's like just goes on a psychedelic rant about the kid's hair growing. You're gonna scare the kids.
But I love that too, because we're almost looking at the head like a crop circle in the
that could have come out of Mandy 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. Love that first shot. What you got coming up next? Cause you got a few before. Oh no, is it mine next? And then yours hits. Yeah, then you have the next three. Okay, yeah. All right, so I'm gonna move on to my next shot, and it's it's the confrontation between Gandolfini and Thornton. I love this shot for so many reasons, and I love this scene for so many reasons. Just we're finally getting that. There's a lot of passive aggressiveness and how people confront one another in this film, where Big Dave, and as like a jock sort of meat and potatoes man that he is, and then I think that's what he means more to the question of
that's
what
such
kind
a
of
great
man
description
are you?
Of his character.
What kind of man are you? Where I'm trying to like, I understand a man like myself that would just come in here and fight me because I'm sleeping with his wife, but you kind of doing this and like, you know, stealing money and like sacrificing my, it's like something like I don't understand you. I think that's kind of more to what, if I were to write from Big Dave's perspective, but I think the existential question that we're reading as an audience as we're watching this as well is, We're getting these, you know, kind of like, how do we define the man that wasn't there, or the disillusionment of this time period? I feel like there's that within the question as well. Some of that weird existential feeling that we get from how we're even introduced to the scene, I think is captured in this shot, to where we're almost in this like endless sea of black, and we're facing into the office from outside the glass. And as he's finally kind of like, we're hitting a tension point. We're hitting the highest point of tension in this the sequence. The glass breaks in the background. I love that we're in, it almost feels like it comes out of nowhere. Like it's almost like breaking the fourth wall, literally, of our screens. With this movement, and then the fine, like how quick and is it, it's almost like kind of something like Hitchcock would talk about, like the reality of murder, or like how small or how fussy a bit can seem, like in Rope, where we're trying to move a body or something like that, or what's the other, Paul Newman one, I'm blanking, but the steps someone had, like when he stabs him in the neck and he like It almost feels too simplistic. We've seen him cut the cigars with this little the cigar knife that he has, and so for him to use it as a murder weapon and just how quick it happens, and then we just Dave, you know, exit stage left immediately. It's kind of it feels there's a banality to it that I think is emphasized with how existential and weird and sort of spacey this felt, that it's over so messy, like human messily. I'm not really explaining this as well.
I know what you mean though, Because it does, like, go from this scene, this shot into him just, like, returning to life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like he just, like, goes back to his job and, you know, Frankie's like, oh, man.
Just starts the music back again.
He's like, I'm hungover as shit, man. Like, how you feeling this morning? And he's like, fine, just fine. I'm fine. Yeah. Everything's totally normal and cool and fine. And I think just kind of the abrupt nature of him, just, you know, kind of just like, oh, shit, am I dying? Am I dead right now? And then falling over dead and him just trying to awkwardly shuffle back to his job and pretend everything is okay. Like, it all works together really, really well without taking away from the drama.
Absolutely. And what you got? You got some awesome ones to round us out with this segment. My favorite scene with Catherine Berwitz here.
My next shot, we already talked about it a little bit. The scene, what's old girl's
Catherine,
name here?
Berwitz. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that last name, but Catherine Cat. Hopefully, maybe that's the
just nah, I mean, she's so fucking incredible. We already talked about how good her performance is. But can't say it enough for sure. But the lighting in this scene is right there swinging for the fences right alongside her. Like, Deacons is just putting all these fucking people up on his back and carrying them into the rafters. Like, this scene rules so hard. But I love the, like, soft stipple, like, very classic, the tree branches, stippled over his face, over Billy Bob's face.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the reverse shot with her in the veil and the hard backlight, like, ugh, so good. So iconic, like, such a good fit. Could have been best fit if it wasn't already best shot. And then even the walk away where she's just pure silhouetted and you got the, like, classic cars, you get the classic street light pool of light and giving her the, like, silhouette with her little wiggle dress that we were talking about earlier. Like, the whole sequence is just pure fucking gold. And especially at this point in the movie too, because it's like shit started to get fucked up, and so the scenes of comedic relief are getting weirder and farther in between. Mm-hmm. And this one hits just right.
In the beginning of this shot where it's we're on the single over the shoulder of Catherine on Billy, I love how crowded the shadows feel or make him feel compressed in this the center part of this frame. So when he's like,
ooh,
there's that in, like, the background of, like, the door where it's silhouetted, where it's like, this all makes it feel eerie to me. And, like, her, like, again, looking off to the side, and, like, we cut back to Billy's shot here, the single of him, like, looking off to the side. Like, it makes it, I don't know, there's a tension.
I really like
that
with him being, like, surrounded too,
yeah,
in the shot,
yeah,
where he's got,
yeah,
like, he's got people all, like, you know, all these silhouettes surrounding him. Like, he's never going to get out.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I never noticed that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Love this scene. Love this shot. Love Carter's score behind this. Love her. Everything about this is chef's kiss. So great shots all around. We're going to move on. Best combo of craft for me. I don't know. Fucking the Coen brothers. Joel and Ethan.
you know who we haven't talked about
combo?
And what's a fantastic scene. It's not necessarily my combo craft. It was almost one of my scene that I'd show to get someone to watch. But the Gandolfini breakdown. We have barely talked any Gandolfini at all.
Yeah, I you're absolutely right. I think
especially you as, like, a big Sopranos head.
I was trying to, like, have my wiring in the Sopranos here. Gandolfini's amazing in this one. And like I mentioned earlier, just his delivery of what kind of man are you. I love everything, too, about the first dinner scene. That's another one, too. That's another, if you were to show, get somebody to watch, is them entertaining for the night and him telling him the story about being in World War II.
Yeah,
like,
some sort of wife there. Yeah.
And him, like Francis McDormand just, like, acting a little too big and, like, laughing a little too big at every joke. And then, like, his wife just, like, not reacting, no selling everything, but just her, like, eyes. So, And then it's sort of like it's in Billy Bob just being dead, essentially looking like he's in the electric chair position. So fantastic. And he commands so much of the room. And that's the other thing with Gandolfini. I don't know if you feel this way or how many roles you've been familiar with throughout his career, but he can. There's still a sensitivity is not the right word, but there's still a vulnerability, maybe, or there's a smallness, an adolescentness to him, almost like a man-childness, somewhat, to where it's deceptive, to where it's almost like a Venus flytrap that like looks, you know, pretty enough that it's going to attract you inside of its jaw until it like snaps. Like they're sort of like in that scene where he's like explaining that. To me, I would have already gotten up out of my seat as soon as he started getting up out of his seat. I don't know why you sit there and let that man get up on you. Like,
oh yeah.
But I think part of this disarming sort of like aw shucksness, a little bit to Gandolfini as a performer, that allows that sort of works for. I may be a little overselling it
I also had written down that, like, Gandolfini's charisma is just, like, shining through the character a little bit.
Yeah.
But it works, too, because it's, like, it's tough. I think it really, really works for the character where you get why he's the face of this business, but he doesn't really own anything.
Yeah.
It's like this is a man who like operates on pure charisma, mm-hmm. and like doesn't really have a lot of substance to back it up. Mm-hmm. And then Gandolfini's like natural intensity to back it up. Also, like when the turn happens and he's like, "No, I beat it out of the pansy," you're like, mm-hmm. "Uh oh!" Like you really do feel scared because Gandolfini's a big motherfucker, and he sells that like intensity really, really well. Of like, no, you're in serious trouble now.
Right.
The only though I had was like, I had read a bit about like he was hesitant to sign on, but he ended up really liking it and felt like it was something different that he wasn't doing in Sopranos. And I'm like, really?
Yeah. Because I think there's more of a joviality to Big Dave, more of an innocence than I think Tony Soprano has. You know what I mean? Like, Tony is a little jaded.
Oh, yeah. He's not just playing Tony Soprano, for sure, but it doesn't feel that far away.
Yeah,
either.
I'll grant you that. But there's even the quality of his voice is different than in The Sopranos, where it's higher pitch and more, like, squeaky, I think, what he's selling here.
Yeah.
Like he had more of a
he's way more salesman,
less
boss.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Fucking nerdlingers. So I love that you stuck with this movie. This to me is one of my favorite.
Oh, I'm real glad you put it on for sure. I talked a bunch of shit about it, but like I think Yeezus was my like moment of brilliance where I was like, oh, I get this. Like, this is
I like
this is something I'll definitely put on again. Nice. There's definitely, you know, parts I'll probably skip.
What parts were you? Is it the Scarlett Johansson bit?
I just don't think the ScarJo stuff pays off enough to make it worth it. But other than that, honestly, it's a banger.
Yeah. I almost kind of feel, you know, we're going to cut this. Oh, banger, boom, cut that. I kind of feel that way about Heat in a lot of ways, like the Natalie Portman stuff and her, you know, the suicide bit and like, you know, her and Al Pacino, like trying to, you know, like I always feel that way about
much
Heat.
Like,
we don't
much like
it.
Matthew McConaughey in Contact.
Yeah,
forgot
yeah.
that she was in that movie until you said that. And I'm like, oh yeah, I have edited that out in my brain.
Right. Yeah, and so I like it a little bit more because I think it's, again, the midlife crisis, him trying to find like a much younger woman bit to it makes me laugh a little bit. Even this is the much more in vain of Captain Hatred that I'm thinking of, but I could see how extraneous it may feel. In the plot, what was your take? You know what we didn't get? This may be on mic. Hold on, we'll cut back into the episode. Before we get out of here, curtain close as we're doing this. What was your take on the aliens? And like, how did you respond to the very end of the film? Aliens making their way outside his jail cell. And sort of ignoring him, or at least acknowledging him and just walking back inside to go finish writing for whatever men's magazine he was writing for. What is your, how did you respond to the aliens in the film?
I mean, the spheres.
Did you pick up on all the spheres? It's almost like the X's you're supposed to see in The Departed, to where you were going to die if they're next to the X's or whatever. Like, it feels like we get the hubcat sphere, we get, there's spheres with the doctor and the it's not the horoscope, whatever the thing
that the
doctors wear. There are a lot of hidden spheres that are supposed to suggest, you know, the UFO that we'll eventually see in the film. How did that work for you? And Big Dave's.
I mean, obviously the Big Dave setup, I didn't pick up on. I think there's some other stuff that, you know, like Frankie's talking about, like the Russians getting the A-bomb. Mm-hmm. Like they're talking about that kind of space race,
yeah,
like sci-fi era shit, like classic shit. So it didn't come as like a complete out of left. I mean, obviously it's a little out of left field, but like it wasn't like, oh, what the fuck. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick up on the orbs for sure. I'm not gonna claim right. that I caught that symbolism or anything. Right. I think it fits in with him, you know, saying that he was a ghost and that, you know, he could see nobody and nobody could see him. Like,
right.
even something as outstanding and extraordinary as like an alien encounter wouldn't leave in the most mundane, boring way that ultimately ended with him like still getting executed. Like I think that's basically my read on this scene is like either one. It's him making it up in his mind because he needs like one last thing to be special. Like he's just desperate. He wanted to make some money doing dry cleaning. It didn't work. He wanted to be a manager for this famous pianist. It didn't work.
Right.
He's like, I'm writing my story for this men's magazine. It's probably not going to go anywhere. It's like, maybe I'll meet aliens. He's like, no, they're going to ignore me too. And it's like, okay, I'm just gonna fucking die. Like, this is my arc. This is, I have a peak. I have a valley. I have a peak. I have a valley, and then you die.
Interesting read. I love it. And again, like I said, I love that you stuck with this movie. This is the Coen Brothers overlooked classic. It's just my take on it.
Oh yeah.
And we're going to move on to another one coming up in our coming soon segment after this.
The Sunday Night Movie.
All right, everybody, coming soon, closing out the All Work, No Play May Day month. Rounding it out with Nat, and she's bringing us 9 to 5. And this is starring Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton. This is I think everyone's pretty much familiar with the song, right? Working not to work.
Oh, yeah. I think it's in my head, like, more often than it's not.
Nat joining us, we want to remind you all that the Patreon Uncle Ann's Private Stash is ongoing this month with a raffle, a really cool Nick Cage jacket, some DVDs, some comics, material that we've kind of covered on the podcast. So join us there for that. Send us your address and or interact with the podcast with a comment, any way, and you're kind of submitted into this raffle. McGee, you've yet to see 9 to 5, right?
Yes, I have not watched it yet.
All right, so
I've been saving this very moment.
So we're going to toss you the poster. We're going to play our Guess the Logline game. This is where you're going to tell us a little bit about what 9 to 5 is about, having not seen it. So you got your poster? Give us a shot.
All right, the poster. Tagline on the poster, we got the power behind the throne. Poster's got Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton looming over a tied up... what's my man's name here? He's Mr. Wall Street.
Dabney Coleman.
Dabney Coleman, a.k.a. Mr. Wall Street. Oh, he is on the poster. I just didn't recognize his name. Because he's just that guy. He's got that face and that mustache.
One of the faces.
That hairline. But yeah, so we got him tied up. Old Dabney getting a rip of black coffee here.
This was Ron Carlisle from Tootsie. This was the director of... he was the salacious director in Tootsie.
Oh, right. Yes. He's great in that, too. Goddamn. Yeah. So this is the real connective tissue.
Yeah.
We also had Lily Tomlin. Oh, I talked about Twins movie that she did.
Yeah, you did.
I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. Big Business.
Big Business.
That's what it is. It's also a fun one to say. Big Business.
A Big Business.
That's Lily Tomlin's only in movies if the title of them gets stuck in your head as like a mimetic phrase. Anyway, so what's the plot of 9 to 5? Jesus Christ, this episode's so long.
So much of this is getting cut.
I can't not think about another movie that I haven't seen, but I only know from the Venture Brothers reference, which is a little whorehouse in Texas or whatever the fuck.
I think you're going to be disappointed there, Doc.
Mano a mano. So what is this? So I want to say they, you know, obviously... they rebel against their boss and run a business themselves. And maybe it's a diner? Maybe they convert their office into a diner?
I thought it was Waitresses, too. I'm not going to lie to you. Before I saw the movie, for whatever reason, because I've answered Jeopardy questions of this movie and got them right, knowing that Dolly Parton was a part of it. But I always thought they were waitresses. No, it is a corporate sort of 9 to 5,
okay,
desk cubicle kind of workplace. But you, I will say that you answered it in its entirety. They do take over a workplace with their from their boss. I'll go ahead and read the log line coming from IMDb. And it's a very simple one. Three secretaries turn the tables on their obnoxious boss. And that's
straightforward.
Yes. So it's a great one, available on your VOD Hangouts or for purchase. And we're going to cover that next week. Really fun film to round out All Work, No Play.
Been looking forward to having Nat back next week.
Hell yeah. Nat back on the pod next week.
Next week. Let's end this episode.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soul Spy. Coming soon, folks.